Now we're on. Okay. All right, so go ahead and take your Bibles, open them up to the book of 2 Kings, chapter 6. We are continuing our Sunday morning series in the divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah. And last 5-6 weeks now, we've been looking at the life and the ministry of the prophet Elisha. So we're going to continue that this morning. And I will give you all the background on Elisha, because you guys should pretty much know who he is. But I want to look at an Elisha story this morning. So last week we looked at the kind of the second part conclusion of the story about Naaman and Gehazi taking on Naaman's leprosy because of his own deadness inside of, because of his own greed. So that was kind of a depressing note to end the lesson on last time. So I want to pick it up again this morning, but with maybe a little bit more of a cheerful note, because today we have a story that's actually pretty cool. Do you guys, and this is, just so you guys know, I'm not very old, all right? Now, I feel it this morning, because I guess I was partying too, Tim, too, thank you. Yeah, no, I was partying probably a little too hard with my wife last night, so this morning I'm feeling it. But I'm not very old. And yet, it's amazing that already, in my 20-something odd years of life, that I can look at the people that I grew up with, look at the people who were my peers, look at the people who were my, you know, the people that I thought, you know, these are the people, I'm never going to lose touch with these people. We're going in the same direction. We're tracking in the same, you know, towards the same goals. And then, you know, it's been a couple of years and people have gotten married and got here and done this. And so you reconnect with somebody and you're like, so what's going on? What's going on with your family? And you find out that their life is a wreck. And I mean, and I'll just say right now, it's the grace of God that my life is where it is right now. And I'm certainly not trying to boast of anything that I've done there, but it's just amazing. You have people and you thought, you know, we're going in the same direction. And then you look at where they are now and and where they are now is, you know, it's very clearly a result of the decisions that they've made to get to that point. But their life is a wreck. One really kind of sad example to me, I guess, is a family that was really close to my family when I was growing up. As a matter of fact, when I was probably about 12, 13, I was best friends with the oldest boy in this family, and my sister was best friends with the oldest girl in this family. We were very close, and we did everything together, and as families, we did everything together. And then something, you know, we kind of, I guess, lost touch over the years, and came to find out a few weeks ago that the family's now split up, and that there's a divorce, and there's been some unfaithfulness, and some other stuff, just not stuff you want to find out about old friends, but it makes you wonder, you know, what could have possibly gone wrong? And even more than that, you look at every probably 4 or 5 years, we'll have some great big either a televangelist or an evangelist, you know, somebody who's in the ministry, in whatever capacity and whatever doctrine that entails, somebody's in the ministry and seems like they have this very successful ministry, and they've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and they've started these big churches, and they founded these great movements. And then something happens, and there's a moment of weakness, and it takes them down. And we look at that, and you wonder what went wrong. How did he mess up? How did she mess up? So what I want to look at this morning, last week I told you how to fail, all right? And this week I want to look at how not to fail. And so so that should be a nice, cheerful transition from last week's lesson. So in today's story, let's go ahead and read 2 Kings chapter 6, just to give you some background here. Well, let's read it, and then we'll get into background. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 8 through 10 says this. Once, when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, "At such and such a place shall be my camp." But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there." And the king of Israel sent to, and the man of God, of course, is Elisha. The king of Israel sent down to the place which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. Okay, so basically here's what's happening. We've talked the last couple of weeks about how there was a nation of Israel, and this is the northern kingdom of the divided kingdoms, Israel and Judah. But then to the northwest of Israel, in what today is modern day actually Syria, and there's a lot of trouble going on in Syria right now. But in what is today modern day Syria, and at this time there was a kingdom called the Kingdom of Aram Damascus, or they're also called the Arameans in some of your history books, and if you see them in the Bible, they're the Syrians, but it's the same people. And the Syrians and the nation of Israel basically had a very antagonistic relationship. The Syrians, it was actually very similar to the relationship between the United States and Russia during the Cold War. So there was sort of the state of antagonism, this sense of warring between them, but there was no outright war declared, and nobody was marching a Syria-sized army into any other nations. But what the Syrians would do, since they were a little more powerful than Israel, is they would put together basically raiding parties, and they would take the raiding parties, and they would go down into the border cities of Israel, and they would take slaves, they would take valuables, and they'd loot and kill and burn and pillage and do all those things, and then they'd skedaddle back up to Syria before the king of Israel got wind of it, and there wasn't really a lot he could do about it. And if he were to make reprisals of his own, then Syria would have used this as an excuse to declare all-out war. So it's kind of in his best interest not to do that. So during this, on this backdrop of terror, this kind of Cold War, God, through Elisha, has been giving victory to the Israelites. Because what happens is, the king of Syria gets together and they said, let's organize a raid, send a raiding party down to such and such a city. And Elisha, God gives Elisha a vision or revelation of what is about to happen. Elisha would send word to the king, and then the king of Israel could either send an army there to meet the Syrians, or he could have everybody evacuated so the Syrians would come and they wouldn't find anything. And this happened over and over and over again. And so the king of Syria, the Bible says in verse 11, it says that the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. So, if you're a king or a president or basically in charge of anything, and you have secrets, and the secrets are getting out, what's the logical conclusion? What's the logical solution for what must be happening? There's got to be a leak, right? There's somebody's spilling the beans. Somebody's getting paid under the table. They're passing secrets. This is a problem. So it says that he calls all of his servants together. So he gets all of his generals and probably all the people in his palace, and gets everybody who could possibly be in the loop on this thing, everybody who could possibly have leaked the information, gets them all together, and he says, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" So basically he's saying, which one of you is a spy? And one of the servants said, "It is none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." In other words, there's nothing, and this servant somehow knows, and we don't really know how he knows, but the servant knows of Elisha, knows of his ministry, knows of what he's capable of, knows what God has been doing through him. And he says, "There's nothing you can say in your bedroom that Elisha the prophet cannot hear." So Ben-Hadad is very upset about this, and he says, "Go and see where he is, that I might send and seize him." And it was told him, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So he, that's Ben-Hadad, sent their horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. So Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, he's angry, he's frustrated, his plans have been thwarted, but more than that, you ladies are not going to understand this, okay, but as a dude, there are certain things that just really, just rankle you, okay, just really, really, as my dad would say, grit your gourd, right? There are certain things that you just can't put up with as a guy. And one of them, at least for me, is when somebody is constantly, you know, thwarting you? Because it's not just that the, okay, confession time. Last night, Sophie and I, every time I think I'm not an angry person, something happens to remind me that I still got to work on this. So last night, Sophie and I had a very nice dinner planned. I had some reservations. It was the kind of place you have to get reservations to, which is, it's a big deal for me to get out of the house in that way. So anyway, we made some reservations, and we were going to this very nice restaurant in downtown Fort Worth, and we got on the road 10 minutes late. So I'm already antsy because there's a certain amount of time in which, you know, I got a certain window in which, after which my reservation expires and this whole thing is for naught. And it's like a 40-minute drive. And so we are probably slightly exceeding the suggested speed limit. And so we're slightly exceeding the suggested speed limit. And because I want to get there in time, and I've planned this big thing, and this has been planned for weeks, and I really want this to go well, and I want it to be nice, and I want it to be special for my wife. So we're booking it down 121, and we make it to, so get this, I left 10 minutes late. I got there 2 minutes late. All right? So I'm like, all right, we're doing good. We're good on time. We're going to make it. And then so I'm like, there's my exit. I'm 2 minutes away. I'm looking down at the GPS. I look up. There's my exit. I am 2 minutes away. We got this. So as I'm about to exit, this white Suburban comes flying by me and cuts me off. And I can't exit. And so I'm driving and the exit is down in my rearview mirror. And the GPS reroutes and says, oh, it's going to be another 10 minutes now. Because there's just no good place. You're going down 121 and there's a 280 exit. And basically, the only way that you can get turned back around and back on 280 is to go south on 287 and then turn around and come back north on 287 to exit 280 again. It's just a whole thing. And so, 10 minutes later, we arrived in downtown Fort Worth. And we're driving down the road, and it suddenly occurs to me, you know, the restaurant is rapidly approaching, it suddenly occurs to me that I had not thought about parking. Now, this is a pretty major oversight when you think about the fact that I work in downtown Dallas where there is no parking, and so anytime you do anything, you have to plan on where you're going to park, and you have to know this in advance. And so I suddenly realized I haven't thought about parking. And so I'm frantically looking for a place to park. And so up here on the right, I spot two different, very conveniently located free parking lots. And I'm like, that would be good, except it's like 4 blocks away, and my wife is in heels, and I don't think that's a good idea. So I keep driving. I keep driving, and I notice up here on the left, ooh, there's another parking lot. And I say, I tell you what, that one actually, it doesn't look like there's too many people in there. It seems like there's some kind of a gate. So you probably have to pay, but that's okay. I don't mind paying for parking. I work in downtown Dallas. I don't mind paying for parking. And then I'm about to turn, and then I realize that the outlet is on the wrong side of a one-way street, okay? And so in order to get to that parking lot, I have to actually go down 3 more blocks, make a left, and come back up. And this is all happening, and as this is happening, I, who am generally speaking, I won't say I'm a laid-back fellow, but generally speaking, I'm just, you know, not so much laid-back as apathetic. Like, most of the time, stuff happens, I just don't care, you know, and I just don't care. But this is a big thing. This is a big night. I planned for my wife. I want this to go well. And my plans are being thwarted by the bureaucrats of the city of Fort Worth who are like, hey, let's plan a city using a dartboard. And so they're throwing darts and figuring out, let's make this a one-way street, and let's make this hey, guess what? Let's not make any parking available. 15 minutes later, because we got to that one parking lot and it turned out to be employees only for this one company, we went to another parking lot and it was all full, and I sat behind a police officer who was blocking traffic because he'd gotten out to talk to a friend in his truck. And if this had been anybody else, I probably would have honked the horn. I probably would have rolled down the window and yelled at this guy at this point. But it was a cop, and I was like, nah, I'm just going to wait. But I'm getting more and more angry as this is all happening because my plans are being thwarted. So 15 minutes later, I call the restaurant. And I'm like, you know, I'm 15 minutes late for my reservation. Is this too late? Are we going to still be able to, you know, go? And she said, normally, you know, we probably would have to say no. But she's like, if you're right here in downtown right now, then just come on in and we'll get you a table. And she did it, and it was great. It was a great dinner. And here's the clincher, though. She says, I said, you know, I've been looking for a parking spot for the last 5-10 minutes, but everything's full. She's like, well, we've got valet parking for $5. And I was like, are you kidding me? Seriously. And so, anyway, I felt really stupid. Felt really, really stupid. So, but anyway, we got there and we got our valet parking. We had a fantastic dinner and it was great. But anyway, all that to say, as a man, when you have plans that are being consistently thwarted, whether it's by an adversary or by your own poor lack of planning, coupled with the poor lack of planning of the general layout of downtown Fort Worth, which I've always been a fan of until last night, actually. When you're being thwarted, it just, as a dude, it just makes you angry. And so Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, he's angry, he's frustrated because his plans have been thwarted, so he sends a small army down to Dothan to capture Elisha and bring him in. So this is going to stop right here, right now. So he sends an army to take Elisha in. All right, so we're talking about how to succeed, and I would even go farther and say, I want to talk about how to succeed against yourself. How to succeed against overwhelming odds. Elisha's odds here are going to be overwhelming, and they're going to be overwhelming in this case because he's going to be suffering for righteousness' sake. But a lot of these same principles that we're going to talk about this morning can be applied if you're facing overwhelming odds for any number of reasons. If you're battling with failure, and going back to what I talked about at the beginning of the lesson, what I kind of want to do is tell you how to avoid that same catastrophic failure that so many of God's servants have experienced. Okay. So the Syrian army shows up overnight. And this is point number one for how to succeed against overwhelming odds, how to succeed against yourself, okay, is realize or recognize the underlying issue. I think a lot of times problems show up and we are blindsided by them. We're blindsided as churches when it seems like things have been going along just fine and then suddenly we have to change the color of the carpet and there's a church split. It's not that the carpet color really matters to anybody, okay? It just doesn't. But very often, that changing the color of the car, I use that as an example because it's the one that everybody thinks of, and I actually know of a couple instances where it's happened. But very often it's something like that that forms the catalyst for all these other tensions and pressures and disunity that has been building up in the church over time. And so you have something that seems like it's happening overnight, okay, but it's not. It's been building up. So the Syrian army shows up. It seems like it shows up overnight. But in reality, there's this long, recurring pattern of events that eventually brings everyone to this place. When we experience failures, when we experience setbacks in our relationship with God and with others, we need to understand that the core issue often runs much deeper than we can see. So in this case, Elisha is suffering for righteousness' sake. And this is true of good things and bad things, okay? If you have somebody who's being persecuted for Christ, it's because they've made a series of decisions that have led up to this time. If you're facing overwhelming odds for a good reason, okay, it's because a series of decisions have been made that lead up to this time. And to properly deal with that, we have to understand what all goes into it. I'll explain more about that in a minute when we talk about seeing things as they really are. So 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 15 through 17 says this. It says, when the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And he said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So Elisha's servant wakes up a little before Elisha the next morning. He's going to get things ready for his master and probably pour some water and make some breakfast. And he gets up, he looks out the window, and he sees that the entire city, which Dothan wasn't a huge city, but it was a little city, the entire city is completely surrounded by a Syrian army. And he wakes up his master Elisha and promptly begins, as I think you would, to freak out, right? He's like, "We're surrounded by an army. There's no way this little settlement of Dothan is going to be able to handle what they're about to dish out. And we can't. What are we going to do?" Now, Dothan was a city or a settlement. We actually know where it was today. And there's actually a little... there's actually a small Jewish settlement that's right outside where the ancient city of Dothan was today. But Dothan is a settlement. It's located adjacent to a mountain. So I actually have a picture up here for you if you want to go to the next slide. This is Dothan. So if you see in the foreground, all right, if you see in the foreground where the stones are, the line of stones. All right, that's what's left of the old city, okay? And then up here on the mountain, up here to your right, that's going to be the mountain that it's talking about in this passage. So you just kind of have that in your head. And today there's nothing there but some shepherds and whatnot, and there's a settlement that's not far from this. Interestingly enough, this has no bearing that I'm aware of on the lesson, but this is interesting, so just for your edification. This is also the place where Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. And so if you look at this slide, this is Joseph's well. And this is the well that people believe that Joseph was thrown down into. And we don't know for sure that's the well, but it's in Dothan and it's a well and it's right there. And that's what people have believed for centuries. So anyway, for whatever that's worth, your little bit of trivia, that'll help you if you're on Bible trivia, this, you know, Trivial Pursuit, the Bible edition. This next week. Okay. So Elisha's servant. We don't actually know who Elisha's servant is here. There's actually a good chance it's Gehazi, but I don't know. So last week we dealt with Gehazi and how Gehazi basically was dismissed from being Elisha's servant and was given Naaman's leprosy because of his sin. But there are a few stories, one in particular, later on in the book of 2 Kings that are kind of out of order. So basically, there's the what happens to Gehazi, but then they give us a couple of stories that are sort of like flashbacks. And the reason is because of the way they were lumping the different miracles of Elisha. So we don't know if it's Gehazi or if it's somebody else. But in any case, his servant is terrified. And Elisha says, "Why are you so afraid? You have nothing to fear." And this is where the cool stuff starts happening. This is really important for you to grasp the lesson. Elisha prays, "Donald, do we know what's..." All right. Elisha prays and says, "Lord, open his eyes that he may see." Now, somebody answer me. Here's a question. Audience participation time. Was the servant blind? Could he not see things? Right, because he couldn't see, because he could see the Syrian army, right? And that's the key. He couldn't see everything, right? That kind of blindness is really important in this story. And the story really doesn't make sense unless you understand the kind of blindness we're dealing with here. So just keep that in the back of your head. In a couple of minutes, it's going to come through. So Elisha prays. He says, "Open his eyes that he may see." And God opens the eyes of Elisha's servant to see what up to this point only Elisha can see. And that is that they are surrounded by an angelic army of chariots and horses that is far greater, that is far more powerful than their enemies. And Elisha says, no, we don't have anything to worry about. But this is pretty cool. It says, when the Syrians came down against him, so the Syrians come into the city and they come to Elisha's house to take Elisha. And Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. The kind of blindness that's being talked about here is not being able to see anything at all. All right? Because these men are going to follow Elisha in their chariots, on their horses. They're going to follow Elisha from Dothan to the city of Samaria. And if you're blind, you basically can't do that. All right? These men are not blind in the same way that normally we would think of blindness. This is a case where God is blinding someone's eyes to some specific details. In other words, they are not able to see things as they are. It said that he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, this is not the way and this is not the city. Follow me and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he led them to Samaria. Okay, so if the servant starts out blind and has his eyes opened, he starts out blind to the reality of God's protection for them, and he has his eyes opened so that he can see things as they really are, the Syrians have the reverse effect. They start out seeing, or at least on some level, probably the same level as the servant, because they certainly didn't see, you know, the angelic chariots and soldiers, but the Syrians start out knowing why they're there, knowing who they're looking for. And Elisha says, Lord, blind these men. And God blinds them to the reality of what is actually there, so that they cannot see what is there. I'm always reminded of the story, and this is one of my pet peeves, just by the way. A lot of people will try to use the justification that there are sometimes that it's okay to lie, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, and this, the one instance that people always give you is, the story always goes like this. If you're Corrie ten Boom, who is does everybody know who Corrie ten Boom is? So Corrie ten Boom is a famous, she was a Dutch woman, and she and her family hid a bunch of Jews during the Holocaust, during World War II. She was eventually found out. She was arrested. She was imprisoned in a really awful German concentration camp. She lived to survive it. She lived to tell about it. She's written books. They made a movie about it. She's an inspirational speaker. She's a devout Christian. And she's somebody who loves the Lord very much. Story always goes like this. If you're Corrie ten Boom and you're hiding Jews and the Nazi, you know, the Gestapo comes to your door, And by the way, in debate, we call this making an argument ad nauseum. In other words, if you want to make your point stronger, throw in Nazis. Everything's better. It's truly amazing. I mean, eventually, any argument goes long enough, the Nazis come up. There's no exceptions to that rule that I've ever encountered. If you go long enough in any argument, any debate about anything that's a matter of principles or morals, eventually the Nazis come in somewhere. All right. So the argument goes, if you're Corrie ten Boom and the Nazis come to your door and they knock on your door and you open the door and they say, are you hiding Jews? Well, if you say yes, they're going to come in and kill the people. And if you say no, then they'll go away. So is it really, you know, it's clearly okay to lie in that situation. That would be all well and good, except for a couple of reasons, one of which is Corrie ten Boom didn't lie about it. So, true story, Corrie ten Boom and her sister hiding Jews in a trapdoor under the table. Nazis come to the door, knock on the door. Are you hiding Jews? The ten Boom sisters, especially Corey's older sister, don't feel it's right to lie. And they say, yes, we are. And the Gestapo comes in. And they say, where are the Jews? And Corey's sister says, they're under the table. And so the Gestapo moves the table. They pull back the rug under the table, covering the trapdoor. The trapdoor is right there in the floor. But the eyes of the Nazis have been blinded to the location of the trapdoor. And they say, we don't see, you know, why. They basically get very mad. They think they're being messed with. They search the rest of the house, and then they storm off in a huff. Meanwhile, the Jews are all safely hidden under the trapdoor that is right there in plain sight because God has blinded the eyes of the Gestapo. All right, this is a case of men being blinded to seeing what is really there. All right. One more example of this in the Bible would be the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, right? So basically Jesus has been crucified, he's come back to life, he's appeared to the 12 and the 40. But so before he's ascended back into heaven, he's walking down the road, and he comes across two of his disciples, and he starts talking to them, and they're very confused about everything that just happened with the death and the crucifixion and the resurrection, and everybody's talking about it. They're not really sure what to believe, what to think. And so Jesus walks up, and they do not recognize that Jesus is Jesus. And so Jesus walks with them, and what I can only imagine would be the greatest sermon of all time. The Bible says that Jesus walked with them an entire day, showing them every point from the law and from the prophets that pointed up to what had just happened. I can't imagine, nothing to do with the lesson here, but I cannot imagine what that sermon would be like to have Jesus pull open the Bible and say, here is everything in the Old Testament that points forward to me. But Jesus does that. And they finally, it's late, they get to the house, they're going to have dinner, and as soon as they have dinner, Jesus prays, and they're praying, and they open their eyes, and the Bible says that their eyes were opened, and they saw him for who he really was. And then he disappeared. Point number two. If you want to succeed against overwhelming odds, see things as they really are. You see, throughout this story, almost everybody, except for Elijah, everybody in this story suffers from a form of blindness. It starts with Ben-Hadad, who is... Okay, think about this for a second. You're the king, and somebody comes to you and says, there's this guy who knows the words that you're speaking in your bedroom. In other words, there's nothing you can say, nothing you can think, nothing that you can plan that this guy doesn't know about ahead of time. And he says, huh, that's really bad. I tell you what we'll do. Let's secretly put together an army and secretly go and try to capture him. Just think about that for a second. You know? But Ben-Hadad, like so many men, is blinded to what God's true power is. He's blinded to God's provision for his servant. He doesn't really believe, he doesn't really have faith in God's power, and so that's why God lets all this happen, is to show him a lesson. Elisha's servant is blinded to God's provision. Elisha's servant wakes up in the morning. Have you ever woken up in the morning and the only thing you can see is your problems, right? You wake up in the morning and it's the first thing in your head, it's the first thing you think about, the only thing that you can focus on is your problems. And that's Elisha wakes up blind to, or Elisha's servant, he wakes up blind to God's provision. And then the Syrians, they're blinded to Elisha's true identity, to his true location. Elisha's, or the Syrians, are not able to see things as they really are. Human beings, by nature, can't see things as they really are. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9 says this. The coming of the lawless one, this is talking about the Antichrist, is by the activity of Satan with all the power and false signs and wonders, and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing. Why? Because they refused to love the truth and so to be saved. And therefore, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what is false. This is the state of man. We don't want to love the truth. We don't want to see what is real. And so God sends a strong delusion so that they might believe what is false, in order that all may be condemned who did not believe in the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness. Romans chapter 1 said this. It says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Why? Who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. Paul is very clearly stating right here definitively that God has put so much of himself in the creation of the world that the truth that can be known about God, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature can be clearly perceived. And yet mankind, as long as we've been around, we've been worshiping created things rather than the one who created them. We've been looking at the majesty and the glory and the beauty of the world. And we've been worshiping the spirits of the trees and the earth and the forest and the water. We've been making idols with our own hands to worship gods of fertility and gods of the sun and gods of the moon. We've taken something as beautiful and as glorious and as wonderful, okay, as food, and we've made that into a religion, and that's called gluttony. And we've made things as wonderful as God's purpose for a man and woman within the context of marriage, and that's become immorality. And all these things are things that are supposed to show us the nature of God. The relationship between a man and a woman in marriage exists for one purpose. Well, it exists for many purposes, okay? But the main purpose that marriage exists for, according to the Bible, is to teach us about our relationship with the Lord. It's to teach us about our relationship with Jesus, in which Jesus is the loving, perfect, selfless, self-sacrificing groom who makes much of us when we don't deserve it. And we are the adulteress. We are the bride who rejects him, who constantly turns away, and yet he pursues us. And he takes us and he brings us back to him. That's what marriage is supposed to show us. But it says that they are without excuse, for although we knew God, we did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But we became futile in our thinking, and our foolish hearts were darkened. And so, says this, claiming to be wise, we became fools and exchanged. And this is what sin is right here. It's exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man. And we do this more than anywhere else. We do this in the mirror every single morning. We focus on ourselves. We make ourselves a priority. We make pleasing ourselves and glorifying ourselves a priority. And we exchange the image of the immortal God for the image of mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. If we want to succeed against overwhelming odds, we need to see things as they really are. But as human beings, our views of things, our view of life, the way we look at nature is naturally distorted. Something is off about the way you and I look at the world. All right? We have what we think about God. I mean, just take this one example of who God really is. There are a lot of ideas out there about who God really is, but there's only one truth. And for a lot of us, our idea of who God really is based on our experience with an authority figure, be it our father or somebody else. And that's the image, it's the pattern of God, and we take the image of the immortal God and we exchange it for something like the image of a mortal man, and we say, because my dad was this way, or because I was abused this way, God must be a cruel, harsh God. Because I was raised this way, God must be loving to the point that He will never punish sin. And we exchange the image of the immortal God for something resembling a mortal man. And a fish does not know he's wet, right? Okay, fish don't know they're wet. Why? Because they're in the water all the time. A fish would notice that it's dry, but a fish doesn't know it's wet, okay? And as humans, we do this without knowing it, without thinking about it. We try to insert our worldview. We try to overlay everything that we look at the world through a particular set of lenses. And so we make decisions about what is right or what is wrong, not based on what is actually right or wrong, but what did this individual deserve, right? I do this all the time. You hear in the news about somebody who, you know, a really awful domestic situation, and somebody finally had enough and they killed this guy, and now they're going to jail, but everybody's kind of like, well, I'm glad they did it because this guy really deserved it, okay? That doesn't make murder okay, right? But we let what we think we or others deserve shape the moral decisions that we make, all right? Ultimately, as Christians, the only way we can see things as they really are is to go through the lens of Scripture. We can't be our own lens because we are warped by our experiences. All right, the experiences you've had with people will color the way you relate and deal with other people who are like those people. The experiences you've had with authority figures will warp and distort your picture of God. And think about this. Every time, but we don't just have our own worldviews to deal with, right? Every time you have a conversation, every time you watch a movie, you are opening your brain up and inviting a worldview in. All right? Every time you sit down in front of the television and watch a TV show or watch a movie or whatever it is, you're opening your brain up and you're inviting inside a worldview. And that's why it's very important, I think, not to just examine the, well, what's the content? Does it not have this? And we go down our checkbox. But really stop and think before we put programming, before we put entertainment in front of our children, really stop and think, what is the worldview that is being communicated? Is this a worldview in which there are moral absolutes, in which there is a right and a wrong? Is this a worldview in which good needs to triumph over evil? Or is this relativism? Is this relativistic? Is this bringing in the world's philosophies and the world's thinking, and is that what we're inviting into our minds? We need to see things as they really are. And very often, when we deal with depression, when we deal with something that's really overwhelming, all right, when you're dealing with the Syrian army in your head, very often the thing that you really need is to see things as they really are. To see God as the loving Father and the dear friend that He is. You need to see others not as people who exist for your pleasure and your comfort, but as people who are there. And I see this a lot in young guys who are just starting out and ready to get married and all that, and they have a particular set of problems, and they look at this young lady as their solution to those problems. And what they don't realize is, and girls do this too, it's not just a dude thing. In fact, girls probably do this more, I'm just not as cognizant of it. But what we don't realize is that when we get married, getting married solves no problems. No problems at all, all right? Getting married, all it does is it takes your problems and it puts them together with somebody else's problems, and then you not only have to work out your stuff, but you've got to work out each other's stuff, and it's a lot harder. So any problems that you'd like to not have in your marriage, you should just take care of now if you're single. All right, just fix them now, and that'll save you a lot of pain and heartache and surprise and really some expectations. I know one thing is, just to be frank with you for a moment, one thing I hear a lot of is, you know, guys, well, I've got this problem with lust, but once I get married, I won't have it anymore. Yeah, I don't know what books you've been reading, okay, but it just doesn't work that way, okay? So all that to say, part of seeing things as they really are is recognizing people for why they're, for their actual purpose, right? And their actual purpose is to be someone, you know, at your purpose for me is to be someone to whom I am a channel and a vessel of the love of Christ. That's why you guys are here. That's why I'm here. That's my purpose in relation to you. So we need to see things as they really are. Okay. I'm strangely running out of time, which is odd because I didn't think I was going to have very much content today. But so let's just finish the story. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 20 through 21. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. I don't know where these guys, I'm actually sort of curious as to where these guys thought they were. You know, if they were, thought they were going on a nice, pleasant walk in the forest, or I don't know what it was they were seeing, okay? But they open their, God opens their eyes so they can see things as they really are, and boom, they are in the midst of the capital city of their enemy, and they are surrounded. And then Joram, the king of Israel, who, by the way, this dude is a complete airhead, all right? And I don't say that lightly, but this guy repeatedly, and Joram's not even a bad king, he's just dumb. I mean, this guy is like, I mean, dumb as a bump on a log. And he's, I mean, it's just every time he comes up, he's saying something stupid, and Elisha's like, no, you should not be freaked out about this, or you really should be more freaked out about this than you are. And we're going to get into Joram some more here in a couple of weeks. So Joram, if you can have this in your head, I see Joram as being this, about a 7-year-old kid with a big, lopsided, oversized crown that's slipping over the front of his face. And he's got a sword, and this is actually what he says. He says, my father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down? And he's saying, Daddy, can I kill them, please? Can I kill them, please? And Elisha's like, no! What is wrong with you? That's not how we treat prisoners, okay? And there are a few people that God has commanded throughout Scripture that if you take these people as captives, you need to execute them, because that's my judgment. But the general command in the law of God was that if you take prisoners, you treat them with love and respect so that there can be healing rather than enmity. And here's Joram just hopping up and down, and he's literally saying, Daddy, can I kill them, please? Can I kill them, please? Just like that. And Elisha says, you shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you had taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. So he prepared for them a great feast. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they came to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. So Elisha treats them with compassion, demands that they be treated with the same dignity that would be accorded to prisoners of war. And it says that after this, the Syrians ceased their border raids on the nation of Israel. All right, so last point here is that you need to sow in love. If you want to deal with overwhelming odds, if you want to be successful in your ministry, you need to understand the fundamental, one of the fundamental laws of the universe. And this is not mine, this is God's, okay? Think about Nazis earlier, that was mine. This is God's law. All right? It's a law of sowing and reaping. Galatians 6 and 7 says this. It says, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever one sows, that will he also reap. And so if you sow in love, you will reap love. If you sow wheat, you're going to grow wheat. If you sow corn, you're going to grow corn. It's really not hard, okay? Whatever you sow is going to be what you reap. Consequences always grow out of that which is sown. So we started the lesson by talking about realizing when you're facing overwhelming odds, realizing how you got there. And this is where that ties in. You need to understand where the decisions you're making right now will get you. When you're dealing with the overwhelming odds of how do I keep my family safe and pure without putting them in a cloister, without rendering them ineffective for Christ. The first thing you need to do is stop and, you know, you're going to see things as they really are, and then you need to stop and say, okay, what are the decisions that I am making right now, and how do they impact my children's future? And so this last 4 weeks, we've been focusing as a church on what it means to be courageous families, on what it means to be courageous moms and dads and brothers and sisters and husbands and wives. Part of courage, all right, courage is not blindly rushing into anything that looks like it might be a threat. That's called stupidity, right? Part of courage is knowing what you're getting into, and it's understanding how things will affect. And this understanding that the things I do now will have repercussions later on, be they good or bad, there will be consequences. That ability to understand that is what the book of Proverbs calls the fear of the Lord. And it says that that is the beginning of wisdom. All right. So when you're facing overwhelming odds, first, you just need to realize how you got there. Second, see things as they really are. And finally, you need to sow in love. Because no matter what your odds are, no matter if you're facing persecution for your witness in Christ, or maybe you're facing consequences for poor decisions that you've made in the past, whatever the overwhelming odds are that you are facing, you need to sow in love and sow things that will reap later on. And so in this case, Elisha treats them with love, these prisoners with love and respect, and as a result, the future Syrian raids are all avoided. So at this point, there's going to be some war with Syria, but at this point, going forward, there are no more of these border raids, this cold war between Israel and Syria that we've been talking about for so long. So I've got some more material and some more expanding I'd like to do on that point, but I want to finish on time this morning. So let's go to the Lord in prayer. Dear Father in heaven, I pray that you would open up our eyes this morning to see things as they really are, to see that all the things that we love and we worship and we delight in that are not you are not worth it in the end. To see the consequences of the things that we are sowing right now and what they will reap in the future. To see the things that we sowed in the past and how we're reaping them now. And God, I pray, most of all, that we would see you, we would see your face, that we would see your glory, and that we would see your indelible image stamped upon every beautiful thing in this world. And that instead of worshiping the created thing, we would worship you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.